TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Cornel West on Democracy Matters. Cornel West was born in 1953 in Tulsa, Oklahoma. He's a prominent American scholar and public speaker. Formerly at Harvard, West is currently a professor of religion and African American studies at Princeton. His thoughts and writings are based on such diverse traditions as the African American Baptist Church, Marxism, pragmatism, and transcendentalism. As a young man, Cornel West marched in civil rights demonstrations and organized to demand black studies courses at his high school. West later wrote that in his youth he admired, quote, the sincere black militancy of Malcolm X, the defiant rage of the Black Panther Party, and the livid black theology of James Cone, end of quote. He enrolled at Harvard University at age 17 and graduated in 3 years, magna cum laude, in Near Eastern Languages and Literature. In 1984, he went to Yale Divinity School. While at Yale, he participated in campus protests for divestment from apartheid South Africa. He was arrested and jailed. He returned to Princeton to become professor of religion. As director of the Afro-American Studies Program, he cooperated with novelist Toni Morrison. In 1993, he published a best-selling collection of essays entitled Race Matters. In 2000, West had become a prominent endorser of Ralph Nader, even speaking at some Nader rallies. Some Greens tried to draft West to run as presidential candidate in 2004, but he refused, citing his participation in the Al Sharpton campaign. Cornel West came to the San Francisco Bay Area in October 2004 and gave a talk on the occasion of the publication of his most recent book, Democracy Matters, Winning the Fight Against Imperialism. Cornel West.
In all honesty, I must say that I think we're living in one of the most difficult moments in the history of the press's experiment called Democracy USA. It is a dark moment, and in such a moment, it's so easy to remind each other of the darkness as opposed to trying to specify the sources of the light. So I'd like to begin today by trying to accent three distinctive features that constitute who and what we are when we are at our best. I'll put it another way, what the past has bequeathed to us that allows us to accent the best of that past. And so I want to begin on a Socratic note in the way in which the book does. This book is not a rant against the Bush administration. That's too easy. And it's not a celebration of a milquetoast candidate from the other party. That's too depressing. I have my choices. There's no doubt about that. And this election is one particular moment in which the choice is crucial. Many of you know, of course, that I supported Ralph Nader in 2000. And this time I plan to pray for Ralph but not vote for him. But I'm not excited about either candidate. But the aim for me is to try to get at a deeper level, the deeper recesses of the democratic experiment. And that's why I go back to the Greeks. I go back to Socrates. I take quite seriously that line at 38A in Plato's Apology, the unexamined life is not worth living. And Malcolm X adds, the examined life is painful. And the Greek actually says the unexamined life is not a life of the human, for the human. And our English word human derives from the Latin humando, which Vico reminds us in the 12th paragraph of the New Science, is defined as burying, burying. And I come from a tradition of a particular people who've had to come to terms with forms of dehumanization such that they begin with what does it mean to be human? What does it mean to be a featherless, two-legged, linguistically conscious creature born between urine and feces, who often buries one's dead in order to acknowledge the fact that who one is intimately connected to who came before one? And Socrates himself raises a question. How does one care for one's soul? This Greek notion of paideia, the formation of attention and cultivation of a self and maturation of a soul, such that in one's brief move from womb to tomb, and the acknowledgement, the consciousness of the fact that our bodies will be culinary delighted terrestrial worms very soon, maybe, gives an urgency and an intensity to the question who we really are as persons. And the best for me, wrestling with what it means to be a citizen, it's the question of what does it mean to be a decent human being and a passionate person in this very dark moment, this difficult moment in American democracy. So we begin with Socratic questioning. And Socrates himself says in his trial, line 24a in Plato's Apology, he says, parhesia is the cause of my unpopularity. What is parhesia? It's the benchmark of any serious democratic project. It is frank speech, plain speech, fearless speech, unintimidated by the powers that be and open to revision. And for me, I believe we're living in a moment where we don't have enough parhesia. We don't have enough frank speech. Why? Because Socrates acknowledges you have to muster the courage to think critically for yourself in order to exercise frank and plain speech. And of course, the history of the struggle for black freedom in America has been characterized by Socratic figures like Frederick Douglass and Ida B. Wells Barnett and Ella Baker and Fannie Lou Hamer, who did what? They exercised frank speech regarding the anti-democratic dogmas operating in the heart of American democracy, a dogma like white supremacy or male supremacy, or vast wealth inequality or homophobia, any ideology that loses sight of the humanity of other persons. And today, dogmas of free market fundamentalism, the fetishizing of the market, unregulated market, unfettered market, unedited market, privatized, deregulates, the mantra vis-a-vis almost every major social problem, resulting in what? Unbelievable levels of productivity, efficiency, no doubt, but unbelievable levels of wealth inequality. 1% of the population owning 48% of the net financial wealth. That was before the tax cut. And we laugh, but we know how serious it is. Because it means the most vulnerable among us pushed to the margins, beginning with the precious children. 20% of America's children living in poverty in the richest nation in the history of the world. That, for me, is a disgrace. It's a moral disgrace. 39% black, brown children, 46% of our red young brothers and sisters on reservations in other places living in poverty in the richest nation of the world. Can you imagine what historians are going to say about Americans 150 years from now? Why the sleepwalking? When did it become fashionable to be indifferent to the suffering of the most vulnerable? Why the priorities tilted toward privatizing and yet public life, health care, 46 million, no access. Child care, millions of young children left alone as their mothers now forced to work, given welfare reform with no job skills or job centers to ensure that they have a secure foothold in the labor force. Decrepit schools, public schools. We're not talking about the private ones in vanilla suburbs. They're doing very well. In chocolate cities, decrepit schools, dogma, dogmas of aggressive militarism. Not simply colonial invasions of Iraq in the name of the liberation of Iraqis. I say, Mr. Rumsfeld, when you shook hands with Saddam Hussein and offered him golden spurs as a gift from the Reagan administration, you didn't have your mind on the suffering of Iraqi people, didn't you? You changed your mind since then. What's going on, you know? When Saddam Hussein was America's gangster, it was fine. Some of us marched against Saddam Hussein in 1979 when he was installed by the CIA. He was a gangster then. But it's not just aggressive militarism outside. It's the militarization of everyday life, machismo identities, cowardly brothers of all colors, engaged in vicious assaults on sisters of all colors, and domestic violence. It's young people having machismo identities, posing and posturing as if the only way they can make it from womb to tomb is by imitating Melville's Ahab in the greatest novel ever written by an American, that 32-year-old Herman Melville in 1851. Ahab says what? I'll dominate my way. I'll conquer my way through my move from womb to tomb. Melville says, the worst of the American imperial mentality. What's the best of it, Melville? I believe there is a best. There's Ishmael. There's multiracial solidarity. There's learning from others. There's humility and magnanimity, very different from American success. And I always remind young people everywhere I go, one of the worst things the older generation did was to tell them for 25 years, be successful, be successful, be successful. As opposed to be great, be great, be great. There's a qualitative difference. Success, very individualistic, privatistic. Concerned with one's own upward mobility. But great, I go back to what I call the Jewish invention of the prophetic, fused with the Greek invention of the Socratic. The Jewish invention of the prophetic in those profound Hebrew scriptures defines greatness as he or she who is willing to serve others, be kind to strangers and widow. To fundamentally believe that what it means to be human is to be compassionate, because there's no self without a other. And there's no self-understanding without you understanding that other. If you demonize that other, you actually degrade yourself. See it in Proverbs 14:31. He who oppresses the poor degrades one's maker. He who is in solidarity with the poor exalts one's maker. We can go on and on. Micah 6:8. Do justly, love mercy, walk humbly with thy God. The fifth chapter of Amos. Let justice roll down like waters, and righteousness like a mighty stream. And I'm not preaching to y'all. I know this is lunchtime. I'm reminding you of one of the greatest traditions that has been bequeathed to us. And how do we fuse Socratic questioning and the exercise of parhesia, the fearless frank and plain speech of unpleasant truths having to do with dogmas, anti-democratic dogmas that are arresting the development of the democratic project, with this Jewish invention of the prophetic that has to do with mustering the courage to care? And I should say rather briefly here that this fusion is a fascinating one and has much to do with the black freedom struggle. Why? Because we know, of course, Socrates, like Jesus, never wrote one word. If it were not for Plato and Xenophon and Aeschines, we'd know nothing about Socrates. But in all the various renders of Socrates, we never ever see Socrates shedding a tear. He never cries. So even given the centrality of exercising parhesia, speaking frankly, I think there's a defect in Socratic level of wisdom. Because anybody who's never cried or shed a tear for me has never really loved. If you've never really loved, it's unclear whether you've ever really lived. Unless you tried to live within the confines of your mind and held your soul at arm's length. Of course, some people say, was Socrates married? Yes, he was. Did he have kids? Yes, he did. So maybe he stole away and cried. But we don't get it in the three sources. But this is very important, because when you talk about democracy, and especially when you talk about a tradition that in part produced me, the struggle for black freedom, and when you talk about the Jewish invention of the prophetic, it begins with the tears, the cries of a hated people, a despised people, an oppressed people in the face of an imperial Egypt, and a higher power that hears their cries and their afflictions. the agony and anguish of the least of these become the lens through which you view not just yourself, because you're never a victim. One should never believe the conservative discourse about oppressed people viewing themselves solely as victims. No. They're talking about being victimized and trying to resist. And same is true in Hebrew scripture. Jewish peoples were never solely victims. They were victimized by imperial elites called pharaohs. And they responded. Unbelievable. Imagination. Courage. You see. And I do not believe, especially in America, but I think this is true for democracies across the board, I do not believe it's possible to engage in the kind of democratic awakening necessary. It's not just about the next election. It's about a deeper paideia, a deeper kind of informed and critically engaged person and citizenry. And I think it's no accident that Judaic effort to create a whole new way of life rooted in tears and cries so that the exercise of intelligence and compassion is always in service of justice, justice, justice. And since 9/11, there's a fundamental sense in which first time in the history of the American democratic experiment, all Americans feel unsafe, unprotected, subject to arbitrary violence, and hated. And yet, to be a nigger in America for 350 years is to be unsafe, unprotected, subject to arbitrary violence, and hated. There is a certain sense in which the last 3 years we've been wrestling with the niggerization of America as a nation and how it's had now to come to terms with feelings of relative helplessness, insecurity, anxiety, feeling that there's forces coming at you that you have no control over and feeling hated for who you are. A number of my white brothers and sisters come up to me. Oh, Brother West, I just can't get over this sense of being hated. Hard to get out of the bed in the right way because I just feel it's so unjust. I say, you don't say. Really? That's new, huh? There's a people in your midst that's been wrestling with that ever since they got off slave ships. Can a blues nation learn something from a blues people? Emmett Till's mother had to deal with terrorism, and her only baby, 14-year-old brother Emmett, he was killed by American terrorists, and she brought his body back to Chicago, kept the coffin open over against the claims of the authorities that be. When 50,000 fellow citizens of various colors walked through that black church in Chicago to see his body, what did she have to say? What response did she put forward against American terrorism, against being niggerized and looking at her baby whose head was 5 times the size of his ordinary head? Mom's Teal stepped up and said, I don't have a minute to hate. I'm going to pursue justice for the rest of my life. What a standard, moral maturity, spiritual strength, still being Socratic. I'm still going to ask them questions about the dogma of white supremacy in American democracy. But I take seriously the Jewish invention of the prophetic link to the Hebrew scripture. And of course, she spoke as a Christian. You can't separate that Jew named Jesus from the Hebrew scriptures. And when she talked about justice, it had to do with ensuring that she would not contribute to the cycle of gangsterization that characterizes terroristic attacks on innocent people. I'm going to stay out of the gutter. What did Brother Martin have to say when he had to give his eulogy when 4 precious girls in Birmingham in September 19th, 63, only time Brother Martin cried in public, tears flowing, looks at the family on the front row, 4 precious babies, friends of the great Angela Davis. She's from Birmingham, Alabama. live right around the corner from 16th Street Baptist Church. Martin, what are you going to say to the world? Somehow we've got to muster the courage to use the armor of love and justice. Justice, justice. Where is the discourse of that level of Socratic and prophetic depth when America is niggerized, when terrorism now attacks all of us? Is it revenge? Hunt them down like cockroaches, long ranger strategies, cowboy sensibilities? Is it demonize the other? Is it reaching out even for the very other that has dehumanized you? Hard to find. Hard to find. The analogy isn't perfect. There's no doubt about that. One was white supremacists coming at the other. Islamic gangsters coming at us. But where is the high quality of public discourse so that we don't find ourselves in a deeper quagmire and a bottomless pit, especially sending an army that's disproportionately lower middle class, working class, and black and brown? I'm glad Brother Michael Moore reminds us of the number of congressmen and women whose young people are fighting in the war. I'm going to use the working class kids as the army for the empire while you're at home talking about how pro-war you are. Something's wrong with that. Deeply wrong. I'll bring this to a close. In addition to the Greek invention of the Socratic questioning and the Jewish invention of prophetic witness, there's the black invention of the blues, the tragic comic. Tragic comic goes far beyond melodramatic narratives of all the good on one side and all the evil on the other, pure heroes and impure villains. It goes far beyond conceptions of democratic experiments as some grand city on the hill, which is a moral exemplar with direct access to purity and innocence. Tragic comic says, no, the good and evil is so interwoven in each and every one of us and interwoven in every democratic experiment known to humankind. Forms of barbarism shot through every democratic experiment. And of course, we know without indigenous peoples, lands and bodies, and without enslaved Africans, without women in patriarchal households, there would be no American democratic experiment, even though those realities are anti-democratic realities. And that's why every democracy is incomplete and unfinished. That was part of the genius of the founding fathers. They included a Socratic dimension to the Constitution called amendments. And they allowed for parhesia, the Bill of Rights, under certain circumstances. 1798, Alien Seditions Act, we're going to suspend it. World War II, we're going to suspend it. World War I, we're going to suspend it. COINTELPRO, Black Panther Party, Fred Hampton, going to suspend it. But basically, we believe in it. But it's on paper, it's precious. And it's up to us, fellow citizens, to make it real, because these rights and liberties are hard fought. You got to sacrifice for them. But tragic comic hope is qualitatively different than American mainstream optimism. Anyone who looks at the world through the lens of one's sensitivity to suffering can never be optimistic. You don't have to read Chekhov or Kafka or Beckett, even though it helps, to understand what I'm talking about. You remember that line, Waiting for Godot? Constant quantity of tears, and the air is full of our cries, says one of his clowns. You see? It's the blues sensibility. It's tragic comic. People say, oh, I'm so despairing now with the debates being so disillusioning and so forth. Goethe says, he or she who has never despaired has never lived. To be human is to make despair a constant companion, but hold it at arm's length, the way Ma Rainey and Bessie Smith and Louis Armstrong and Sarah Vaughan and Curtis Mayfield and Luther Vandross do as artists. You only think that despair is something alien to you if you're residing in some realm of purity. And of course, in the U.S. experiment, the grand practitioners of democratic individuality, blues artists and jazz musicians. Why? Because they must find their voice. Imitation is suicide. Emulation is a sign of an adolescent mind. How do you mature? You don't just grow. You got to grow up. Will America grow up and have for the first time a tragic comic hope that it can learn from its blues people and its myth? And by blues, I'm not talking about skin pigmentation. There's a white brother born in Mississippi named Tennessee Williams. He's a white literary blues man. It's no accident that his first collection of plays was called American Blues. And the American Hamlet in Blanche DuBois' Streetcar Named Desire. She's a blues sister. It's not a question of pigmentation. It's a question of, do you have the courage to think for yourself, care for others, and still have the courage to hope, but recognizing you're always radically cutting against the grain. God, I wish I had more time, but you are here. So I'm going to stop. We're going to open it up for questions and queries. Thank you all so very much.
That was the author, activist, and professor of religion and African American studies at Princeton, Cornel West. He spoke on the occasion of the publication of his most recent book, Democracy Matters, Winning the Fight Against Imperialism. Cornel West is unusually politically active for a scholar of his reputation. He has been involved with such projects as the Million Man March and Russell Simmons Hip Hop Summit, and worked with such controversial figures as Louis Farrakhan, who he has actively criticized, and Al Sharpton, whose 2004 presidential campaign West advised. Cornel West is the author of many books, among them Race Matters and The African American Century, How Black Americans Have Shaped Our Century. You can find more information on Cornel West on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under Newest Programs. I hope you have a pen handy to take down a phone number. You can get a one-hour tape or CD that includes the lively question and answer exchange with Cornel West by calling us. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations. Your tape or CD order is the only support we receive and makes it possible for us to stay on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape by mail or credit card, by phone or on the web. Our toll-free phone number 877-TUC-TAPE translates into 877-882-8273. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.